Well, hello and welcome to the TAA Audio Conference, Contract Negotiation, E-Books and E-Rights with Lisa Moore. Lisa is principal of her own entertainment and intellectual property practice, the Moore Firm, LLC. She lectures around the country on music, film, television, publishing, copyright, and new media issues. Her practice focuses exclusively on both litigation and transactional entertainment and intellectual property matters. In recognition of her extensive experience in the entertainment industry, she was recently chosen to serve as editor of Volume 5 of Matthew Bender Entertainment Industry Contracts. Lisa will be taking questions at the end of the call. To ask a question, please press 1 on your phone keypad and you'll be put into the question queue. You can also type your question into the participant dashboard. A link to your dashboard can be found in the email containing your call-in instructions. If you included a question in your registration form, I will read those to Lisa during the Q&A portion of the session today. So I now turn the session over to Lisa. Hello, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks, Kim. Thanks kindly. I want to take just a second to thank you for the opportunity to be here with everyone today. This is a very exciting subject for all of us, practitioner and content creator alike. As Kim indicated, I have been practicing in this space for quite some time. For the better part of 15 years, our firm has had the pleasure of representing authors and technical writers across all genres. In addition to academic works, textbooks, professional development materials, we represent a number of fiction writers, chick lit, children's, mystery, romance. Really, if anybody can write it, we've done a deal on it. And that's been wonderful. It's very rewarding professionally to work with authors like yourselves. As you know, the book publishing industry has faced and undergone enormous changes, and the e-book is largely, apart from piracy, the e-book is largely responsible for that time of transition. We could spend 4 hours, as I said to Kim earlier, about any of these specific issues. So what I'm going to try to do in our limited time together today, because I want to make sure I leave ample time for your questions and get all of your questions answered, I'm going to talk just very briefly about the history of e-books as the evolution of e-books and e-rights. It really has been a fascinating process from a legal standpoint to watch unfold. I'm going to also address current trends in our space with respect to e-books, and I'm going to do this on a macro level. I'm going to do that on a micro level in terms of contract negotiation, specific royalty issues, standards, and then touch on, highlight another additional time-sensitive issues emerging with respect to e-books from a legal perspective, from a political perspective, from a content creation perspective. So without further ado, let's just talk just for a moment about the history of e-books to frame our discussion. As many of you may know, Michael Hart is largely credited as being the inventor of the e-book, and this happened when he typed the Declaration of Independence into a computer in 1971. I'm sure some of you are laughing. He actually predicted, interestingly enough, in an interview with Wired magazine in the late 1990s, that in 20 or 30 years, and he says, quote, there's going to be some gizmo that kids carry around in their back pocket that has everything in it, including our books. Wow, wasn't he prescient? In 1990, some of you may remember, Sony actually released the Data Disc Man, and this was an electronic book player that used CD-ROM technology, and it sold for around $450, with discs for the device selling between $30 and $50 a pop. While the device had moderate success in Japan, suffice it to say, it never took off here in the U.S. due to price and convenience issues. And then almost a decade later, in 1998, the Rocket e-book was launched by Nuvo Media. Some of you may remember that. But again, with not much success due to the price and the lack of availability of e-books to utilize with the hardware. It really wasn't until 2007 that modern e-book readers launched and enjoyed immediate market success. Now, for those of you that have been in the publishing space for some time, whether purely on the academic and textbook side or on the fiction side or across any genres, really, you'll recall that 10 years ago, all the major publishers that we deal with were launching ebook initiatives. And you'll recall that those started and stopped rather quickly. There was really no market for it. There was confusion about distribution, and many of those programs were folded altogether. They were just considered a dramatic failure. But after these e-readers were launched in the market, several years after that, we've seen a resurgence in e-books. And while the original e-book that came out, the original e-reader, if you will, the modern one that we consider the Kindle, in 2007, it originally sold around $400. But given its size and its convenience, it enabled consumers to store many more books without requiring the additional physical space that had previously been necessary for CD-ROMs. And so this is a much more appealing product for the public. And then, as everyone knows, in 2010, Apple released the first multifunction tablet device. That's the iPad, of course, incorporating the iBookstore application into the software, which made purchasing and reading ebooks much more convenient. So that's just a snippet of history. Walk down history lane for a minute. And I want to talk about some macro-level trends with respect to ebooks in the publishing industry. And this crosses really all genres. So I'm speaking to a larger audience of authors with respect to the facts and figures I'm about to give you. And then we're going to drill down into some royalty-specific issues momentarily. So with the skyrocketing sales of Kindles and iPads and other e-reader devices, we finally are seeing record-breaking ebook sales. I speak frequently, as Kim indicated, on the national and international circuit regarding book publishing issues, negotiating book deals, ebooks, new technology, and I can tell you, as recently as a couple of years ago, the fraction of ebooks sold compared to hardbound volumes, traditional print volumes, was still very, very small. In many ways, it mimicked what we have seen in the music space with respect to the lawful purchasing of digital music compared to unlawful digital distribution or traditional record sales. And so the numbers in the past 2 or 3 years have shot up dramatically. It's been astounding to watch and fun to see how this has affected, for good and bad, the publishing industry. So let's talk about the revenue related to ebooks just for a moment. It may be interesting to note that 18% of ebook publishers, and I'm just talking about ebook publishers for the moment, I'm not talking about all publishers, 18% generate more than 10% of their revenue from these sales. 10% generate 7 to 10% of their revenue. 15% of those publishers generate 4 to 6% of their revenue from ebook sales. 43%, shockingly enough, generate only 1 to 3% of their revenue. And 14% generate 0% of their revenue from ebook sales. And I think that while we talk at length in the press and on legal panels and in meetings with clients regarding the tremendous escalation in ebook sales, what we know still is that there are a number of publishers today that are not currently publishing ebooks. And it might surprise you that that number is 62%. 22% are not currently producing ebooks but plan to do it in the future. Whereas 62% are publishing ebooks, 22 are not doing it but plan to, and 16% are not doing it at all, have no plans in the future for their titles to become ebooks. And I think this is very interesting. It speaks volumes about the nature of some of the systemic changes that we're facing in the publishing space, sort of like we did in the music space, where we're going from a purchase model to an access model. And in terms of preferred e-readers, it's interesting that 25% of consumers prefer their iPad to read their e-books, whereas 18% prefer either the Kindle or their own traditional PC or Mac, and 9% prefer reading over their phone. So, as I noted earlier, for the first time in history, adult ebook sales were actually higher than hardcover sales. In the first quarter of 2012, ebook sales constituted $282 million compared to $229 million for print works. If you compare that to the first quarter of last year, ebooks were at $220 million, whereas traditional print volumes were at $223 million. So now, for the first time, we can say that ebooks, adult ebooks, that is, are outselling their print ancestors, if you will. And I think that because of this, because traditional print sales are declining, because piracy continues to be an intractable problem for the publishing industry, because people are becoming more comfortable and conversant using their e-readers and utilizing e-books and purchasing e-books. I'm amazed when I watch my 9-year-old buy e-books on her Kindle, with my permission, of course. As technology has become more accessible for a wider swath of consumers, those that are elderly, those that are young, those that may have disabilities, there's some very new exciting products, as you know, for those that may be vision impaired or hearing impaired. What we're seeing is that the publishers realize that income from traditional print sales is declining, and they anticipate that that income will decline precipitously. And therefore, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, when we were negotiating any given book deal, whether it was with a major publisher, and you know, one of the world's largest, down to a very small independent, to a university press, e-books were certainly on the table and they were negotiated, but they, in large respects, were not an afterthought so much as still considered a new technology that would be governed by the 50-50 share of net receipts. Those e-books, as you know, are often always outsourced to technology companies. They're generally not done in-house by the publishers. And that was considered, you know, an ancillary right with a third-party license, and that was a 50-50 split. What we see now is markedly different. We see that royalties for e-books, if you will, and I'm going to talk more specifically about what exactly I mean when I say e-books, have decreased substantially. Now, of course, it's always a question of negotiation as to what your client, your author, can command. We are seeing some publishers who are starting ebook royalties at the same rate as standard book rate, which could be depending on where you are in your career and the expectation for pushing through the book to market, anywhere from 10% to 20% if you know that, for example, the entire university system of Georgia is going to pick up a certain biology book. So there is a wide range of royalties that we're still seeing with respect to the traditional print books, depending, again, on how much leverage you have, how much they want you. As an example, we're doing a book deal right now for two academic writers based out of Chicago and Philadelphia. They wrote a groundbreaking book that was published by ISTE, and their second book, we're now in a bidding war. We've got five publishers who every day are calling and begging to up the ante. So, again, it's always a question of leverage. It's always a question of negotiation. I don't want to suggest that everybody can expect to start at a certain royalty rate. But what we're seeing with respect to ebook royalties specifically is that they're starting much lower than they did 3, 5, and 7 years ago, markedly lower. Now, there are still several publishers, if they want your client badly enough, that they will share royalties at a 50-50 split. But for the most part, we're seeing ebooks starting at either the standard book rate or, if not starting at 10 or 12 or 16%, sort of maxing out at 20%. And when I say ebook rights, I want to be very clear that I'm really talking about two different categories of rights. There are obviously non-dramatic reproductions of the verbatim text. This is sort of when I think about a book just scanned and I'm reading on a computer as opposed to touching the paper and looking at the binding and all the things an old school literary publishing lawyer like I look for, sort of like the equivalent of reading liner notes in an old record. So on the one hand, you have obviously verbatim textual copies, if you will, just simply distributed in a digital across a digital platform. There are what we now call e-derivatives, which is a much more wide-ranging, broad grant of rights, and that would relate to any and all electronic derivatives based on the original work. And that could be an audiovisual work, that could be a CD-ROM, that could be anything related to podcasts. There are so many technologies emerging in the space right now that the negotiation over e-derivatives, I mean, sort of the imagination is the limit on all the things that that could entail. And what certain publishers are focusing on with respect to their concerns about e-derivatives or what they really want are, can be markedly different than what other publishers are looking for, depending on where you are in the space. So in terms of the royalty negotiation, I would encourage you, obviously, to do everything you can to, well, number one, I hope that you will certainly use an experienced literary publishing attorney to help you and guide you and give you good advice. It's very unfortunate when we see clients come in the door who did not have good counsel their first go-around, and they've been locked into a very bad deal, and it affects subsequent works. I'm not saying that for any self-serving purposes. There are many, many very experienced literary publishing attorneys around the country, and I hope you will certainly avail yourself of one, although we'd be happy to assist you. And that lawyer will be able to tell you, based on prior deals with those publishers, other authors, similar works, what you can anticipate. And again, it's always a question of negotiation and leverage. So I hope that's helpful in terms of giving you some information about sort of the general channel that has been drug between content creators for academic books and professional development materials and other educational textbook works and the publishers, what you can expect with respect to e-royalties. It is next to impossible, regardless of how much leverage your client has, to exclude those, meaning get them out of the deal altogether. Your client would have to have a tremendous amount of clout. There are certainly certain rights that are easy to get off the table and out of the discussion still, for example, film rights or television rights, or our academic writers frequently reserve certain rights with respect to their own professional materials, creating their own professional development materials to supplement their income, direct sales. There are lots of rights that we can reserve, but reserving e-rights generally on a wholesale basis is next to impossible these days. So you have to make sure that you and your lawyer work together to make sure the definition is narrowly defined, and that you are reserving any rights that you may think that you want or need down the road. And this is very important. Right now we have an academic writer whose first work was published by the world's largest academic publisher, and they had a very good counsel assisting them in the negotiation, reserve certain rights. And they actually have the right to go to competing publishers and publish these professional development materials. So they're going to be getting the benefit of a number of top publishing marketing departments and that push and leverage across many business platforms and business units. And that's very difficult to do, but it can be done. So the long and the short of this is that great attention must be given to the way that e-rights are defined. If you are in a situation where you are forced to give e-rights and you have nobody else at the table and they won't come up more than 10% or 12%, or you're starting at your standard book rate, 16%, given where you are, and it could be lower, it could be higher, and you really don't have a lot of leverage, then you really are going to need to use your best efforts to get a reversion of rights. Most publishers will agree that if they don't exploit any particular medium within some commercially reasonable amount of time, 18 months, sometimes a year, and if your client has a lot of leverage, those rights would revert. Or again, there could be some reservation of some subset of the e-rights to the author, and that could be very beneficial in many respects. So I want to talk for a second about some of the interesting litigation that you may have read about. I also want to talk for a moment about some of the other trends that we're seeing. Many of you may be aware that Judge Denise Coate just recently, September 6, approved a settlement between the U.S. Justice Department and three major publishers, which stemmed from a civil antitrust case that accused certain publishing companies of collusion in the pricing of digital books. This was a very high-profile piece of litigation, one that we were watching very carefully. And you may know that the Justice Department originally filed a suit against the five major publishers, claiming that there was a lack of price competition and accusing these companies of conspiring to raise the cost of e-books. This case was settled, and the court approved the settlement, as I mentioned last week on the 6th, or 2 weeks ago, I guess. Now, the settlement calls for the publishers to end their contracts with Apple and the other ebook retailers that contain these restrictions on the e-retailer's ability to set the price of the ebook. This was the gravamen of the complaint and the focus of the antitrust violations. There will be no more most favored nation clauses. As many of you in the space may know, the settlement was widely criticized by print book retailers like Barnes & Noble, and it was also widely criticized by authors' rights groups like the Authors Guild, the American Booksellers Association. What's going to happen is it will allow ebook retailers to drop the price of ebooks, which many people understandably believe will drive Amazon's competitors, all the other e-retailers, out of the market. Which could be a significant blow to all of us in this space. I love to read blogs on literary publishing and ebooks, and I'm going to recommend a good one to you. Many of you may already be aware of it. It's by Joe Wickert, who's a former vice president and executive publisher at John Wiley & Sons, and he is currently the GM and publisher of the Tools of Change conference at O'Reilly Media. And he publishes a blog called Publishing 2020. And I recommend it to you. And if you go on some of his recent blog posts, he's asking some very insightful, thoughtful questions about what this settlement means for folks. What does it mean for Barnes & Noble? What does it mean if Amazon is the only one that can afford to sell ebooks at $9.99 and no one else can keep up? He posits, and many pundits agree with this, that Barnes & Noble, to survive, their only option will be to offer consumers some type of low-end device for free and secure a long-term revenue commitment from these consumers, sort of like the way cell phone service providers work. He also puts out there an interesting idea that some of you may have considered or thought about. Why, for example, can't we as purchasers, as consumers, purchase extra book content from right inside the ebook? We do a lot of video game work in our practice. We represent a lot of video game designers, and as you know, although many of the social media games, for example, are free, there are frequently in-game paid upgrades for more levels, specific tools, more areas to explore in the game itself. And so Wickert says, well, for example, if we look at the autobiography of Steve Jobs, he paid $15 for that. But he was hoping to find more content, and he had to scour the internet looking for YouTube interviews and product releases. And what would happen if we allowed consumers to purchase a premium upgrade where that additional content would be right there in the ebook rather than searching for those videos themselves? It's a very interesting question. Another interesting question he raises, which many of you may have asked yourself, is what about used ebooks? You all are probably very familiar with the basic a fundamental tenet of copyright law called the first sale doctrine, which means if you buy a physical copy of a book, obviously you haven't bought the copyright, you don't have the right to reproduce it or distribute it or publicly display it or perform it if it were a play or create digital copies. All the exclusive rights a copyright holder has under Section 106, but what you can do, because you own the physical chattel, not the copyright, but the physical chattel, is you can sell it, resell it, you could donate it to a library, you could give it to a friend at a book swap, but we can't do this with ebooks. Why? Because the courts largely construe them as licenses, and you don't have the right to sublicense it or resell it, if you will. And many people view this as problematic for a number of reasons. Are there not significant benefits that could be utilized from these used ebooks? Would authors benefit from a used book system, even if they're not getting paid anymore because their content is reaching consumers who would not have otherwise bought the book at full price? I think that's a really interesting question regarding the ebook system and whether we as publishers and authors and those representing publishers and authors in the space could benefit from offering more rich content in the original ebook that might not necessarily be passed to the subsequent reader, but that reader could repurchase that upgraded content at an additional charge. It's sort of like an analogy to the Vargas contract that emanated out of New York for visual artists. So if an artist early in their career sells a work for $500 and they become the next, Michael David, and their works are selling for $40,000 or $60,000, when the gallery sells it, you know, the artist is not going to benefit from that second sale. But under this contemplated contract, the artist would participate in the resale royalties, if you will. So it's sort of along that thinking. We know that companies like Amazon are making a significant amount of money on the used print book industry. So it'll be interesting to see how they try to figure out what they do with these used e-books. It's a very interesting question. And we should think for a moment, you know, can publishers force consumers to buy the print book instead of the e-book? Well, that's a pretty dumb thing to do because we know what studies show is that delayed releases for e-books result in an overall loss of sales and net revenue and profit to the publisher and the author. So delaying e-book releases, which is sometimes thrown around in book contracts or as a point of negotiation, may be penny-wise and pound-foolish, if you will. So I think that these issues related to copyright concerns and fair use and first sale doctrine are all fascinating to me as an IP lawyer working in the book publishing space. I want to give you a few more facts and figures regarding the e-book market right now. Currently, let's see, 53% of publishers are outsourcing the production of e-books to technology companies, as I mentioned earlier. Most of them are not doing it in-house. And as I noted earlier, one out of five e-book publishers generates more than 10% of their revenues from e-books. And two out of three ebook publishers have converted less than half of their backlist titles to ebooks. So I think what that says is there are significant untapped ebook revenues to be shared by all. When you look at the bestseller list, we know that 32 of the top 50 have sold more digital copies than print copies in the last year, which can be attributable to, I think, a number of things. I think it's easier for people to use this technology. The number of e-readers given as gifts over the holidays or for birthdays, that sort of thing. And if you look at Published Green, which is an e-book publishing company, they provide a lot of very interesting statistics on their website. They estimate that 114 million e-books were sold in 2010, whereas the e-book sales for 2011 were just under 970 million. That was a 117% increase from 2010, for those of you that want to do the math. And many forecasters predict that ebook sales will be expected to reach $9.7 billion by 2016. I think in the last moment or two we have, it's important to note that with respect to academic works and technical works and other works in the educational space, e-rights and e-books are even more important as schools and boards of education and other thought leaders in the space are really thinking about how to transform education as we know it, whether it's design thinking or flipping your classroom or utilizing other digital tools that will enable classes to engage with others around the world. Simultaneously, the sky's the limit for e-rights from my perspective for authors and for publishers. I think the question is, how do we do this to the benefit of all, and how do we do this in a way that doesn't run afoul of the Copyright Act or other intellectual property protections, and how do we do this in a way that maximizes the exploitation of content in a manner that does not jeopardize our overall mission and goals as content creators. And by my clock, it says 1:30, so I really would love to open up the floor and take some questions. We can drill down deeper onto any of these sort of top-level broad brush points we've discussed in the first half hour. So, Kim, I'd be happy to take some questions.
Thank you, Lisa. If you want to ask a question, please press 1 on your phone keypad and you'll be put into the question queue. You can also type your question into the participant dashboard. A link to your dashboard, again, can be found in the email containing your call-in instructions. I'm going to start by reading some of the questions that were asked when some of you registered. So here is one by Fred. When e-rights are granted in a contract, what is the current norm for royalty rates? What are the best e-royalty terms you've negotiated for a client or know about in another context?
Sure. Well, that's a great question and one we addressed a little earlier. I will say that 50% for e-rights, whether it's e-derivatives or verbatim e-reproductions, as I'll call them, 50% is the best that anyone can get, and that's becoming very, very difficult to achieve for clients, even clients with a proven track record, proven sales of X units, a real wide target audience. So 50% is certainly the best. Most content creators, most authors in this space are not going to get that, or maybe even anything close to that. You certainly shouldn't be getting anything less than the standard book rate, and if possible, pushing to 20%. But if you have a lot of leverage or you have many people interested in the work, 50% is still attainable in very limited circumstances.
All right, here's another question from John. I'm hoping to be offered a contract in the next few months and wondered how to calculate what I'd actually end up paying for an attorney to review the contract. What's the typical rate for a contract review?
That's a great question. And, Kim, before I respond to that, I'm assuming everyone on the phone knows about the great program that you all have to assist, the grant program. Is that correct?
Well, hopefully. We've been promoting it, but in case you don't know, TAA is currently offering members up to $1,000 to cover the costs of a contract review. And I will it's for first-time textbook authors, so you this has to be your first contract. And I will send some more information about this contract in a follow-up email that I'll be sending out to everyone after the call.
That's a great program and so generous. I mean, what a wonderful benefit to your members. So to answer the question, what can you generally expect? Well, that depends on a number of factors. And let me tell you, we have done almost identical deals for two clients with the same publisher. Perhaps the negotiation and review for one client was a couple thousand, $2,000, $2,500, $3,000. We have other deals where, for the same publisher, for a very similar work, where the client wants to spend an enormous amount of time on the phone or doesn't really have a good working knowledge of some of the underlying issues or wants to go round and round and round and round with the publisher. So we have 22 rounds of comments. Yes, can you believe it? We've gone 22 rounds on a deal as opposed to two rounds on a deal. So the price of a negotiation, if you will, depends on a number of things. It depends on if they send you over an enhanced draft, meaning you're getting a better offer than most people, the first draft, that automatically is going to reduce your cost because it's less time that your attorney has to spend redlining, meaning making edits to the document and then sending it back over. And so there's a process of comment and review. You know, you make your initial edits on behalf of your client, you send it over, and if it's a work that many publishers want, the great news is it's generally very short and sweet. Great, we accept all or 90 or 70% of your changes, whatever the number is. Here are the few open issues we need to discuss, and we put it to bed. If your client doesn't have very much leverage, then you get into a situation, if you've been offered a poor draft, you have to make more red lines, and then many more terms and conditions become the subject of discussion because they weren't amenable to your red lines, and that can be a more expensive process. So it's a little counterintuitive. It seems like it's much cheaper for authors who are getting bigger deals, who have more negotiating power. You think it'd be more expensive from the legal fee standpoint, but conversely, it's generally not. So I think that it depends, Kim, on a number of factors. That's a great question. You can estimate somewhere for a review between $1,000 and $5,000 if it's a very complicated, drawn-out deal. But I would say somewhere between $1,000 and $3,000, probably $1,500, $2,500 being the average for a very straightforward deal with a publisher.
All right, thank you. I'm going to switch over and take a live call now.
Great.
All right. Okay, Ken, go ahead and ask your question.
Hello. I had about 5 years ago signed a contract for to do a print book, and then the recession hit and the publisher decided not to do it. And now, with things improving, the publisher wants to do it, but as an e-book. So I'm going to be getting a new contract. I'm just wondering, since I've never seen an e-book contract before, is there anything different that I really need to watch for or look out for when the new contract arrives?
Well, I think, you know, everything old is new again, that expression. I think many of the most significant terms and conditions that you find in a traditional book deal are equally applicable to an e-book deal in terms of the grant of rights. How narrowly defined, how broad is the grant of rights? Is it structured as an assignment of copyright? Is it structured as a license? Is it just a North American deal? Is it a worldwide deal? Does it involve lots of ancillary and subsidiary rights, or is it simply to publish the book in book form, e-book form, and be done with it? So the grant of rights, for many of our academic writers, issues relating to the cost of permissions, releases, marketing and sales, revisions, author copies, reversion of rights, which I alluded to earlier in the call, competing works, next works. And then for my academic writers and my professors, you know, speaking opportunities and workshops are generally a very, very significant issue that we will negotiate. So I would say that an e-book contract requires the same thoughtful review that a traditional book deal involves.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Ken. All right. I'm going to grab a question off of the participant dashboard. This is a question that I'm not sure exactly what he is meaning, but how do you go about generating author-produced copy?
Okay. Author-produced copy. That's a really interesting use of words. In one respect, it sounds like, how do I write the book? You know, how am I generating my own content? Or I think probably what he means is, maybe he means self-publishing. Maybe he means, you know, doing a self-publishing and distribution deal, and many people are doing that today. I mean, I think depending on what part of the book publishing world you're in, whether you're a fiction writer or an academic writer or you're doing chick lit, there are clearly certain genres, there are certain universes of content that don't necessarily need a traditional publisher anymore. I think if you look at, for example, some of the things that's been happening with the Kindle direct publishing on Amazon, you know, Kindle has enabled authors to self-publish on its Kindle e-reader devices. And if you look at some of the early reviews, you know, allegedly there are people that are making a lot of money doing this, self-publishing without a publisher being involved. They're taking up to 70% of the royalties from the sale, 70 as opposed to, you know, 18 or 20% where you're maxing out even for a very high-profile author with an established track record. There's an enormous difference in terms of in-pocket monies. Now, having said that, you know, you continue to read, you know, on an almost daily basis on CNN or The Times about how this person that self-published on Kindle is making six figures every single month. Well, I'm sure that's true, but recent studies suggest that most self-published ebook authors make very little money. And in fact, a recent 1,000-person study that was released earlier this year found that do-it-yourself authors generally make $10,000 a year on average, and half of them make less than $500 a year. So if he's asking about how we self-publish today, well, there are lots of ways to do that. If he's asking how do I go about entering into one of those agreements, well, that would depend on who will be distributing the content. I mean, there are obviously lots of self-publishing places that simply do the reproduction and then you sell it yourself. There are other places that act as content aggregators, if you will, and then there are obviously the Amazons of the world where you can self-publish directly onto their e-reader. So I'm a little bit confused about exactly what the question relates to. Maybe if that person is on the call, he or she can elaborate.
Okay. He does have his hand raised, so let's give him a minute to explain.
Perfect.
Hi, Jack.
Are you there? Hey.
Yes.
What I mean is the complete layout of the text, all the mathematics, all the figures in place, just like you're going to produce a PDF, but would be going to a commercial publisher like Prentice Hall or Pearson or something like that.
Yeah,
so
well,
what's the mechanism for doing that?
That's an excellent question. I mean, that's not a legal question. So I leave the graphical layout and the textual layout to the people that do that best, which are the editors and the people in the graphic design department. And
but there is a cost
question.
Involved. But there is a
well,
cost involved.
Is,
that's saving money for the publisher.
Well, sure. And, you know, in terms of how you're formatting your own work, I mean, as you know, generally the first draft or the first couple of drafts of a manuscript are going to be at your expense. I mean, obviously the house is editing and providing other editorial assistance and things like that. Once you sort of get to proofs, as you know, if you make more than generally 10% of substantive changes, that's going to be at your expense, and you can sometimes cap that if you've got a good author who they really want. But in terms of the most cost-effective way to lay out graphics and numbers, I don't know. There are probably lots of people that know the answer to that question, but I'm not one of them because that's not the part of the business that I'm in, I'm afraid.
That's still not the question I'm asking. I'm saying that if an author lays out the complete final production version,
uh-huh.
How does this translate into the contract negotiation? How does that affect the amount of royalty they might get back?
Well, if you deliver a print-ready manuscript, whether it's an e-book or a traditional hardbound volume, it's not affecting your royalty rate. I mean, that's not something that goes into the negotiations. Well, I'm going to save the publisher more money on the front end, therefore I get paid 16% versus, a 14-point royalty to start with. So that's generally not part of the dialogue or even in the vernacular in negotiating the contract.
Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. All right, another question is, the contract I've been offered distinguishes between e-books and electronic publication except e-books. I assume electronic publication includes things like sales for database access. What else might be meant by this distinction?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. And I can tell you, if you took 100 publishers, small to large, they all define and delineate e-rights in different ways. And so those are always defined terms. And to answer that question, I need to look at the draft, the proposed offer, and be able to tell you. I mean, sometimes, e-book will be defined as narrowly as I said earlier, which I alluded to, which is simply and only and nothing more than a non-dramatic, exact, verbatim reproduction of the text. Other times, e-derivatives or e-rights or e-books in and of itself can be defined to encompass literally anything and everything, any type of ancillary right, any derivative. I mean, as you know, what is a derivative under the U.S. Copyright Act? It's a new work that is based on an old work. And so any type of derivative work could be encompassed. We see this very frequently with the major academic publishers, that the grant of rights with respect to e-books is so broadly defined and encompasses any of the traditional digital platforms that we're thinking of now and then any more that will be devised 20 years from now that we're not thinking about. So that's a great question, but it's a very fact-specific question and depends on the exact verbiage of the contract.
Okay, thank you. Here's another live question from Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Is that me, Kim?
Yes,
Michael
it is.
Lenny.
Thank you.
I have a question with regard to how often you're able to do this and what your thoughts are on some of the nuances that we do with print royalties. For instance, scaled royalties, maybe scaled royalties tied to sales where they go up at certain levels. Limited term, say 5 years, 10 years, as opposed to the royalty or the life of a copyright, or stepping back from that, maybe set for renegotiation in 3 years or 5 years out when things may or may not have settled down a little bit more as to what is the appropriate royalty rate. And lastly, out-of-print clauses for electronic works?
Yeah, those are all excellent questions, so let's address them in turn. Let's take royalties, print royalties. As you know, it's never going to be an initial draft from a publisher, but you should always ask for escalation. And they may, you may start at, for example, 10% and escalate to 12.5% upon 10,000 copies and escalate to 18% or 15% thereafter. You may start at 15%. And or 12% and escalate after the first 4,000 copies. Each publisher generally has a different way that they like to do escalations. One of the other major academic publishers, they don't do their escalations at 4,000 or 10,000. They do their escalations always at 7,500 copies. So escalations are a critically important way to ensure that you are sharing in the economic upside on the success of the work. You should always ask for escalations, always. An experienced lawyer will be able to help you understand for that particular publisher, and given your leverage and negotiating power, if you will, where you can expect to fall, or the narrow range within which you can expect to fall. I mean, I can tell you that we've dealt with one particular academic publisher who, you know, has one of the largest footprints in the world, and I'd never seen a deal where they'd gone north of X. I won't tell you what that is. But we had an academic writer who they were desperate to have, and they came up with a number that I've never seen put on paper to date by a publisher. So it's always a question of negotiation. You know, obviously, for textbooks that the royalties start as low as 10, and they are as high as 20% generally for an author that has a lot of leverage. The advances range from, you know, nothing sometimes, unfortunately, to a couple thousand, a de minimis advance. It's a lot of money to a lot of people. Or, you know, those advances can range up to $200,000 for a textbook that we know has firm placement in a school system and that will do well and has a demonstrated track record. So you should certainly ask for escalation. With respect to term, I've been negotiating book deals almost day in and day out for many, many, many years, and I've never seen or have seen very few book deals that were structured on a 3 or 5 year term. There are lots of licenses we do in other mediums that's a routine term, or that 3 or 5 years would be a long term, frankly. Like, we obviously do a lot of work with talent endorsement deals, and those generally are very short terms. Or if you're dealing with software or source code or other technology, those licenses are very, very short. But the overwhelming majority of book publishing contracts, regardless of genre, regardless of the type of publisher, are for the life of the copyright. And that's why your next question, the out-of-print question, is so important. How do we define out-of-print? Well, if a book is still technically in print because one e-book is available, meaning nobody even has to buy it, they just in theory could buy it, that book is never going out of print. It is a literal impossibility. That's why we would always require that e-books are excluded from considering whether a book is out of print. There have to be print copies, and there have to be print copies in excess of a certain amount, a certain number of units sold across one or two accounting periods. Because the rights of reversion and the out-of-print clause may be the only thing to save you if a publisher has put your work under their proverbial bed and aren't doing anything with it and it's not generating any sales. And with respect to the term, I want to say that many times with our academic publishers, we are able to structure the book deal as a license as opposed to a copyright assignment, and therefore the copyright registration is kept in our author's name, not in the publisher's name, but it takes some leverage to do that. So I hope that's answered your questions on term escalation and out-of-print clauses.
Thank you. Yeah, I could ask you questions all day, but...
You know, I could answer them all day, but for another time.
Sure.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, we have another question from the dashboard from Roger. Could you comment on your experience with the increased piracy risks of ebooks versus traditional print copies, and whether those risks are addressed in typical ebook publication contracts?
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, you know, when you think about piracy obviously decimated the music business, and then as bandwidth was increasing, it begun to have very deleterious effects on the film and television industry, and now here we are. It is wreaking havoc on the publishing industry. So what we know is that it is so easy to get content now. Pre-release date content is being leaked and dropped. And so as IP lawyers, we recommend obviously copyright registrations. There are some pre-registration things you can do with the U.S. Copyright Office to protect against certain works being released and infringed prior to their formal release date. You know, how to protect against piracy? I mean, I guess in theory you take your jump drive or your hard-bound manuscript and you lock it in a box and you only give your editor the key. And I mean, piracy is a very, very, it's an intractable problem. And every time we find a new way to mitigate against it, there's a new key that pushes it forward. So piracy is a tremendous problem, obviously in China particularly. When you go over there, you know, every book and movie and CD on the street is obviously either pirated or, you know, some of the part of the gray market or a counterfeit good, if you will. So you just have to be very careful. I mean, what do I recommend you do? If you have proposals on some of your academic works, don't show them to people without, number one, having a copyright registration on file. If there's enough expression there to merit a copyright registration, obviously you cannot get a copyright on ideas or concepts or an outline. You know, it has to be a fleshed-out treatment. Use non-disclosure agreements. By contract, you can keep the people, you can bind them from disclosing anything related to your work. You should obviously be using non-disclosure agreements if you're discussing with potential publishers or potential editors or potentially anybody that would contribute to your project, whether it's somebody considering writing a foreword or somebody that may contribute a chapter on your particular textbook, what have you. Using non-disclosure agreements are a good way to protect. Copyright registrations are imperative. Copyright notice, which has nothing to do with registration, is also critically important. Therefore, you don't run into the innocent infringer defense. I'm not sure how to protect against piracy generally, apart from doing all the things you can do with common sense to protect yourself in terms of not putting your materials on the web or having lots of discussions without non-disclosure agreements in place. Or being sloppy or losing your materials or anything like that. Is it? I mean, I don't, piracy is a problem that's bigger than all of us, but there are certainly things you can do that will mitigate against that risk.
Thank you. We have a question from BP. Go ahead.
What exactly is the concept of this used e-books? I can understand for the hard copies, what used hard copies are, but how do you sell used ebook?
Well, you can't. I mean, that you can't right now. You know, let's pretend, for example, that at the library, you know, there was some mechanism for checking out used ebooks. Well, you know, Section 108 of the Copyright Act may, or Section 107, there may be certain defenses we could assert. But if I, for example, had a way of capturing all my ebooks on a jump drive and I sold it to you for $100, that is not protected by the first sale doctrine. That is clearly a violation of copyright. It violates the right to reproduce and the right to distribute, the right to display depending on the format, all exclusive rights under Section 106. So, I mean, those questions, sort of esoteric questions maybe that are more suited for the ivory tower, are really sort of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, they're serious in one respect, but what we know right now is the way the courts view e-books is that those are licenses, and they cannot be resold by you, and they cannot be sub-licensed. That's not permitted by Copyright Act. So unless there's a change, a statutory change, I think that what that means is there's going to be a large universe of e-books that are discarded and aren't used, and query whether that's good for any of us. I don't know. I mean, it's an open-ended question, but the law is pretty settled on the fact that, you know, the first sale doctrine is not going to apply to e-books.
Okay. Thank you. All right. We have another question from Bill. Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, when you get a contract, is it both print media and also the e-books, or is it typically one or the other or both? And is it a good idea to have both? Because who knows if you're going to have an e-book or not down the road a lot of times.
That's a good question. And, Bill, it's nice to hear your voice. I know exactly who you are. Hello. That's a great question. You know, Bill, generally 99.9% of all of these contracts come over with the grant of rights, and then e-book rights are an ancillary right that are in the document. You sometimes do see e-book-only contracts, certainly, but for the most part, publishers still want to reserve the right to publish in book form and in e-book form. It's very difficult to carve out e-book rights from a traditional publishing deal for all the reasons we've just discussed. And frankly, it's not good for the author or the publisher to say, well, we're not going to drop an ebook for 6 months until after the release of the print copy. You know, 15 years ago, we spent a lot of time negotiating, for example, a holdback on paperbacks, whether it was a mass market paperback or a trade paperback, some reasonable window to let the hardbound volume take legs and so we wouldn't inadvertently lose sales. And I think there was some logic to that, but what the studies are showing is that, you know, holdbacks and windows on ebooks with respect to print volumes, you're just losing money. You're not protecting sales. So I suggest that from a publisher standpoint, obviously they're always going to want all the rights. And it's your job and your lawyer's job to narrow those rights to something that is workable and mutually agreeable and palatable, and generally that will obviously include the conveyance of your rights.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to take another question, and this question was asked a couple of times in a couple of different ways, but it's essentially the same question. I have several old contracts. How do I get e-rights? Another person said, I recently negotiated my first contract, and the publisher was quite rigid about royalty percentages for e-books, e-rights, but put in writing that we can renegotiate in good faith if industry standards change. In your experience, is this something publishers will revisit? So one is, if you have an old contract, can you get e-rights? And is this something that you should not negotiate strongly in a contract and hope that the publisher will renegotiate that later?
Okay, well, that's a great question, Kim. And, you know, there's obviously been lots of very high-profile cases about whether old book deals encompassed e-rights and e-books when e-books were not in existence at that time. And you may or may not be aware, those listening, that there was a split in authority. Some of the courts that looked at that issue took the position that if a old book deal, even if we could not conceive of e-rights at that time, says all mediums now known and hereafter devised, well, that includes things that we couldn't conceive of at that time, and therefore e-books are included. There were other circuits that took the position that it's impossible to grant rights with respect to things that we can't conceive of today. And even if it has that broad language, you know, that catch-all, all mediums now known or hereafter devised, we don't think that really means e-books. And so it was a very, frankly, results-oriented wave of litigation. It's a non-issue now because e-books are always in these contracts, always. So how do you get e-books? Well, I need to see your contract. I need to see the exact language that was used. I need to read the grant of rights. There are a couple of basic principles of contract construction that we use to determine whether something was granted or not granted. And, you know, for example, I could make a grant that my grant includes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but it doesn't say H. And so there are some contract principles I could say, well, if it's silent as to H, it did not include H. Well, there are other reservations of rights or catch-alls that can be used to sort of override that. So even if it doesn't say H, I can make an argument that it did include the e-rights. So I can't answer that question without seeing each and every contract specifically. That is a question of contract interpretation. So that answers the first question. And then the second question, Kim, about whether we should go ahead and negotiate e-book rights, of course, they should be negotiated up front, and you should get the most money you can at the outset. You know, this language in contracts about how the parties will negotiate in good faith later is legally meaningless. You're powerless. You're in a power-down position. So you have to. You have no choice for a number of reasons. Certainly your own self-interest, economic self-interest, but to negotiate those terms on the front end and make sure that you're clear about what those rights are. And perhaps, you know, in the e-book context, the e-royalties, if you're starting out very low, you could ask for escalations just like we do for print works. But again, the range is very wide still with respect to where everybody used to be at 50%. Now some people are starting at 10%, and a few people are getting 50%, and most people are getting somewhere in the middle, whether it's 12% or 16% or 20%. So there's a lot, I think there's more room for negotiation now with respect to e-books, unfortunately, for content creators than there was 5 years ago when, you know, e-books were largely still considered a new technology subject to the new technology third-party license splits, which have historically always been 50-50.
All right, thank you. I know we're getting up to the top of the hour. Lisa said that she wouldn't mind going over time a little bit today so we can get through a couple more of these questions. Today's audio conference is being recorded, and you can listen to it later. If you do have to go right at the top of the hour, you won't miss out on this end part of it, but I hope you'll stay on. There's a few more questions that I would like to make sure we get answered. So here's one from John. Derivatives could be made from the work which the author drafted and copyrighted and which the publisher is offering a contract on. What contract section typically defines who can make and profit from any derivatives? Would this be the definition of e-rights or the definition of an e-book or some other clause?
Well, that depends. I mean, across sort of the standard publisher templates, sometimes the rights to derivative works are included in the original grant, which is generally provision number one. Sometimes they're included when the contract addresses what we call ancillary and subsidiary rights. Sometimes they're addressed in their own e-book section. So that varies markedly across contracts. The salient point is not necessarily where in the contract it falls. It's what does it say? And again, sometimes we see e-books very narrowly defined, and sometimes they literally would swallow everything and the exception and the rule. They're so broadly defined. So that's a question of contract interpretation, and we need to look at the actual document.
Okay. So a couple more questions that were sent along with the registration. Could you comment on how best to address the increasing tendency for publishers to insist on merging potential electronic rights with print rights, even though the primary product is to be a print copy?
Sure. Well, I think that the arguments that we used to make against the publishers for keeping those entirely different are largely diminishing for some reasons beyond our control. I mean, back in the day, with respect to third-party licenses, whether it was a book deal or a record deal or, frankly, a film deal or any other content deal, really, new media, new technology, third-party licenses, the royalty split has almost always been 50-50. The problem is that e-books are not new technology anymore. I mean, they're ubiquitous. They are in every part, every element of our day-to-day life. And so, therefore, the publishers are saying, why would we pay 50% on an e-book when we sure as heck don't pay 50% on a print volume? Now, you can point out to them that their costs are different, sure, but they like to dismiss those arguments. So I think the challenge is that print sales are declining for publishers. Therefore, they recognize that the real profit centers are or will become related to digital rights, and therefore what do they do to protect those income streams? They decrease the royalty on e-rights, which is exactly what they're doing. So this is a trend that is continuing. It's consistent. It's unfortunate. And we fight the good fight every day, and sometimes we're very successful in maintaining the 50-50 split for e-rights, but it's becoming very, very difficult in this climate.
Thank you, Lisa. Here's another question from Jay. I don't like turning over supplementary material from my textbook to the publisher because it muddies the ownership waters. Therefore, is it best to maintain an independent personal site webpage that is an e-supplement that I clearly own and can make available to anyone on my terms?
Well, if your publishing contract allows that, or you can get the publisher to agree to that, of course. I mean, there are lots of ancillary income streams that can benefit an author or a content creator when they're reserved to you and you alone exploit them and you're putting all the money in your pocket for the sales or licenses of them as opposed to some very small fraction, 10% or 12% or 16%, depending on what it is. There are many contracts where what you've just posed would be a clear material breach of contract, and you could be sued by your publisher. So the question is, does your contract allow for that? And that is a question of contract interpretation. I just have to see what the language says, and I could tell you, obviously, yes, you can, or no, you can, or there's ambiguity, and we'd have to introduce parole evidence to see what the intent of the parties was. You should always strive to make the grant of rights as narrow as possible for all the obvious reasons, and some not so obvious. But, many academics and textbook authors are incentivized to create their own PD material. That's nice money in their pocket. They don't want to necessarily share keynote monies or other workshop monies. There are lots of derivatives that we would want to reserve to the author. So, yes, always reserve as many rights as possible. That's the short answer, and that's always the right answer.
All right. Unless there are any other live questions, this will be our last question. If you do have a live question, press 1 on your phone keypad. What is your advice regarding the self-publishing of a traditional textbook combined with an online electronic version of the same book? My target audience would be upper-level high school mathematics with innovative content.
Sure. I think self-publishing is a great way to go, except for situations where you don't have access to the decision makers or to the purchasers, if you will, or to the schools. Anybody can, lots of very talented, smart people can write textbooks, just like lots of very smart, talented people and not so smart people can write works of fiction, and anybody can make a record, and anybody can put any content they create on the internet today. The question is not can you create it, and the question is not can you make it available or how to make it available. The question is, are people going to buy it? Are people going to buy it because they can find it? Are people going to buy it because it provides value? Or is your target audience going to be able to find it where you have it? Is there a disconnect between your distribution? So I think you have to really ask yourself. I think the answer is yes in many situations. Self-publishing is a good way to go. But if you, for example, we did a book recently for a professor who, a pottery professor, self-publishing that book was not a smart model because they were not going to ever get the types of sales that this particular university that has a real emphasis on pottery, and they're tied into all these markets and world-renowned potters and pottery institutions and all the trade, if you will, sort of networks and publications. And I think you have to ask yourself, do you need a publisher? Do you need a publisher to get you into a certain audience or to market you or to, what benefit is the publisher providing? And if you can get to the same people without the publisher, self-publishing is always the way to go because you're going to make more money, it's going to be less of a hassle, you're going to own all your own rights, and it's a win-win-win-win-win all around. If you self-publish and nobody can find your book or the right people can't find your book where you have it and you sell 2 copies, well, you may have kept, 100% of those 2 copies, but if a major publisher could have sold 100,000 copies or 200,000 copies, that's a big difference.
Thanks, Lisa. We do have a couple more live questions. So,
okay,
hi,
I got
Greg.
A few more.
I'm sorry? Lisa, did you have something else to say?
No, I said that's fine. I've got a few more minutes.
Okay. All right, thank you. Gregory?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes.
Okay. How do you apply for copyright?
Sure. It's very easy to apply for a copyright registration. You can do it online. The Copyright Office's website is copyright.gov, and it's actually an excellent resource. It's very easy to do. You can do it online. The process is changing. Back in the day, many of you probably remember, you had to fill out a form depending on what you were registering. So, for example, if you were registering a book, it was on the TX form. If you're registering a painting, it was on the VA form. If you're registering a play, it was on the PA form. If you're registering a sound recording, it was on the SR form. You get the point. You had different forms for different mediums. The Copyright Office changed that, and they're now utilizing one common form that can be done online. It's much cheaper that way, $35, and you get the registration back much more quickly. If you mail in the old paper forms, it takes somewhere between a year and 2 years to get it back, and if you do it online, it's somewhere between 3 and 6 months. Copyright infringement matters have a very short statute of limitations, so it's critically important that you register as soon as possible. If you don't, in the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions in the United States, if you don't have a registration back from the U.S. Copyright Office, you cannot institute litigation. There are only a handful of jurisdictions where simply having made application, even though you don't have a file stamp registration back, will allow you to invoke the jurisdiction. So the other benefit of doing it early that you can register multiple unpublished works on one form and save yourself a lot of money. So the copyright form in and of itself is about 9 questions, and half of them are your name and address. It's very easy to do. Having said that, if you have any problems, you can certainly call the Copyright Office or talk to an experienced IP lawyer to help you. But it's very, very easy to fill out a copyright registration. You basically fill out a very short form, attach a copy, or mail in a copy, depending on exactly what you're registering, and then you mail in your payment, and then you patiently wait. And you should certainly send it return receipt requested so you have proof that it arrived.
Okay, last question. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi, Lisa. Say, you answered my question previously, but I just wanted to add one qualification. What if you put ancillary materials online? You're not going to charge for them because the book is already too expensive for anyone to buy. So what you want to do on your web page is to provide complimentary materials free to the students or to anyone else who wants to use them to kind of compensate for the overpriced book. So there would be no limitations on that in connection with your contract, right?
It depends. Let's say, for example, you created a teacher's guide or a Q&A or a proposed test kit
supplementary readings, for example.
Exactly. Well, a complementary reading, a different reading, is not necessarily a derivative work. So we need to be very careful and distinguish, Dave, between complementary works that are not derived from the original work and then derivatives. And when I say derivative, that's a technical definition in my world. I mean, as an IP lawyer, derivative means something. It means it's a new work derived from an original work, okay? There are elements in the original work that extend to the new work. So if, for example, you signed a book publishing contract and you assigned the copyright, and as you know, under Section 106, one of the six exclusive rights a copyright owner has is the right to create derivative works. That's an exclusive right. If you assign the copyright to the publisher, and what you're posting online is actually a derivative, and they have the exclusive right to make derivatives, you could be sued for copyright infringement. Now, that's a very different situation than you post ancillary supplemental materials that are not derived from the original work. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So whether you can do it depends on exactly what your agreement says and on exactly what you're putting up. And I can think of lots of situations where you could be putting up things that – you know, whether your grant of rights was as drafted as broadly as possible and you didn't have a lawyer, or as narrowly as possible because you have a lot of leverage, that there are things you could do that either would or would not run afoul. And so it's very fact-specific. If, for example, I'm teaching a course on art history and I want to put up some photographs, obviously those photographs are not derived from my textbook, right?
Correct.
I mean, you may have other copyright issues, other fair use issues, depending on who controls the copyright to the photographs or the images or the paintings or whatever you're utilizing. But if the works you are posting are, as from an IP lawyer like myself, would be fairly considered derivatives, meaning they are derived from the original underlying work, and your book publishing contract, you've conveyed derivative rights, absolutely, you could be guilty of copyright infringement, even if you make no money.
Okay. What if related to but not derived?
What I suggest you do, and that's why the negotiation of these contracts is so important, that you have somebody experienced on your side that can make sure you don't run afoul of any landmines like this and that you reserve all the rights to do all the things that you want to do that make good sense for all the reasons you've articulated.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, everyone. I know there are a couple other questions, but Lisa has been very generous, giving us 10-15 minutes extra of her time, so we're going to wrap it up. I do want to remind you of the textbook contract review grant that TAA offers. For those of you who are writing your first textbooks and have not yet signed a contract with a publisher, TAA is offering a grant of up to $1,000 for members and $250 for non-members to cover the cost of a contract review. I will include a link to more information about the grant, including how to apply, in an email following today's call. Thank you, Lisa, so much for sharing your expertise with us, and thank you all for participating in today's audio conference.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Kim, for having me. Thank you all for attending.
Thank you. Contract Negotiation, eBooks and eWrites by Lisa Moore is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association. For a full list of upcoming audio conferences and webinars, please visit www.taaonline.net/TAA teleconferences. Thank you.